Surprise! It's a bonus edition of Behind the Lens. Welcome back to this bonus episode of BTL Radio Show. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, makeup artists, sound editors, mixers, designers, VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. And you all know how much I love film, how much I like to talk, and what a joy it is for me to give all of you a front row seat to how the sausage is made, the who, what, where, when, why, and how movie making with these interviews and, by extension, my reviews. I've had done so many terrific interviews of late with some very energetic and enthusiastic filmmakers, and all rather lengthy. Over the past 10 days, every interview I've done has been over an hour long, some stretching to an hour, to 90 plus minutes. And I just can't fit all of that into our weekly Monday show. But because of the fun and enthusiasm of these filmmakers, I want you to hear and enjoy that enthusiasm rather than read a written feature. So, you're getting some bonus episodes, and this is one of them, as I chat with director and editor Josh Dragota and tiki mug collector and film subject Doug Finney Finical about the documentary Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession. Kabali made its Los Angeles premiere at Dances with Films a few weeks ago. What a fun film, and what passionate and engaging guys. I, for one, have always admired the artistry of tiki mugs, but until this film, I never knew the history of the tiki culture. Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession fills that void as it examines the history, artistry, and resurgence of tiki culture through the collectors, artists, and enthusiasts who helped preserve it during a period when much of the culture was disappearing. And did you know that tiki culture, as it's called, started right outside of LA in Venice, California? Seems fitting. Directed by Josh Dragota and edited by Josh, Josh is a veteran editor specializing in commercial production, trailers, and docs, along with editing on projects linked to, such as trailers, linked to La La Land, Bullet Train, Severance, and Percy Jackson and the Olympians. And yes, I do like Percy Jackson and the Olympians. Kabali marks his feature directorial debut, though, focusing on the evolution of tiki mug collecting from a niche hobby into a worldwide community rooted in design, craftsmanship, nostalgia, and preservation. The film also follows Doug Finney Finical, a longtime tiki collector whose extensive collection of over 1,000 tiki mugs inspired the creation of Kabali, a modern speakeasy-style tiki bar in Oro Valley, Arizona. A longtime dream of Finney's. Now, by way of history, by the early 1990s, many classic tiki bars had closed. You've seen them. Look at any beach party movie, any Frankie and Annette movie. And even, you know, I can't even think of the name, the Vincent Price movie, the Harvey Lembeck movies. But you take a look at any of those and you're going to see tiki bars. But they kind of faded over the years. That was at the height of mid-century America. Now, since that time, by the 1990s, many classic tiki bars had closed. And ceramic tiki mugs, which you could get at bars. You know, it's like going to Vegas and pay an extra $5 and you get to keep the glass. Well, you could buy tiki mugs. And a lot of the tiki bars had their own design mug just for them. Maybe a precursor to Beanie Babies and all these other collectibles that are unique and original. But they ended up, people just dumped them. And they ended up in thrift stores, swap meets, flea markets. Even Grandma didn't keep them in her china cabinet. Now, in Venice Beach and throughout Southern California, however, collectors and artists began rediscovering these objects and documenting the larger culture surrounding them. Boutique publishing, conventions, and early internet forums helped fuel a renewed interest in tiki history and aesthetics. And yes, I am proud to say I do own a couple tiki mugs that are about, they're 45 years old now. And I may look to acquire more, just so when I die, my brother has more things to clean out of my condo. Or when I move, it's more things to pack. But with emphasis on California's role in shaping the original tiki movement, from the mid-century explosion of Polynesian-inspired restaurants and bars across L.A. and Orange County, to the artists and collectors now preserving the legacy. Now, I've been to a few tiki bars in Vegas and in L.A., and if you're in L.A., there are still some great ones that have been around forever. Tonga Hut in North Hollywood on Victory. Tiki Tai on Sunset. They're still open. Now, I think everybody heard of Trader Vic's. Well, that's gone bye-bye. But Trader Vic's is still global. And supposedly is returning to a new location in L.A. sometime in 2026. Well, we're halfway through 2026, so my bet is probably not till 2027. But tiki bars are fun and entertaining, just like this documentary and these filmmakers, just like Josh and Finney. Now, hand in hand with the exploration of the tiki culture and artistry, we follow Finney's journey as he tries to build his dream, his quote-unquote, as he calls it, his speakeasy, Kabali, a tiki bar in Arizona. Who would think put a tiki bar in the desert area of Arizona? Finney. From location to color to decor to tiki carvings to a lava wall, which is beyond cool, we actually hear from the architects and contractors as they meet the many challenges of Finney's dream project. So determined to build Kabali, you're going to hear Finney talk about how he even sold his house to get money for the build. Yes, sold his house. That's how passionate he is. Or crazy, we haven't decided which. Over 100 interviews were conducted for this documentary, including appearances by actress, comedian, and former Dancing with the Stars, Kate Flannery, who I love seeing on the TCM Film Festival carpet every year. Kate is a tiki devotee, which now you all know what I'm going to ask Kate about on next year's TCM red carpet. Then there are interviews with Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Todd Rundgren, painter, designer, and illustrator Shag, the incredible Sven Kirsten, who is the author of The Book of Tiki, which is considered the Tiki Bible. He likens himself to being a tiki archaeologist. Fascinating interviews. And of course, a wide range of artists, collectors, musicians, and tiki historians, all connected to the culture's ongoing revival. Now, with the mix of interviews, archival materials that include films, home movies, photos, verite footage, and very stylized and beautiful cinematography, Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession goes beyond the collectibles themselves and looks at the community that formed them. And Josh has done such a beautiful job integrating those ideas. Seamless integration. And it doesn't feel like a history lesson. This documentary never feels like a history lesson, let me tell you. And as you'll hear in this interview, Kabali was a multi-year project with an unknown outcome. The editing, it's non-linear as we jockey back and forth. We go from September 2023 back to 2022, then jump to January 2023. Then we jump to June 2023, August. Then we go back to July 2022 and back and forth and finally into January 2024 and February 2024, which is when Kabali finally opened. But it works. The nonlinear structure works. And Josh and I really dig into that in here. But, you know, part of it was embarking on this project. It was an unknown outcome. It's going to go one of two ways. Either Finney got Kabali built and completed, or he didn't. In which case, do you shut down the whole project, or do you just focus on the tiki culture and its history rather than bring in this personal connective tissue with Finney and his dreams? So, you know, Josh breaks all this down, the challenges and the creative process behind editing the film. And this is where his background as an editor comes into play. And he made the very deliberate choices to intertwine the two narrative threads, the broader history of Tiki and the specific story of Finney and Kabali's creation. And he discusses how the visuals, including beautiful, beautiful, vibrant, technicolor colored cinematography by Ryan Mahaly, an expert color work by David Taylor, were designed to immerse viewers in the world of Tiki, paralleling the artistry of the mugs and bar with the film's own visual style. Dynamic camera angles, close-ups, and color. We discuss it all as a way to highlight the craftsmanship involved in both the mugs and the bar's construction. I got news for you. When you see the documentary, hearing what the contractors, the individual contractors and builders and artisans have to say is really fascinating, as what they have to consider in terms of building something structurally feasible, but also fitting in with the design of a tiki bar and things like a lava wall. And as I said, we spend a good deal of time touching on the editing process. And Josh goes into great detail talking about how he cut two separate linear films, one about Tiki history and one about Finney and Kabali's construction. Then he merged them into the final nonlinear narrative. So he actually cut three films. And he also notes the difficulty of deciding when to stop filming and interviewing, and acknowledging that some of the interviews took years to secure. And that was because important to Josh was to include a wide range of voices from the Tiki community while condensing a visually and historically rich story into a tight runtime. And we also delve into the films, the sound design, and the music. And we talk about Silas Height. Silas Height's main title score, along with Tony Marsico's musical contributions that blend surf rock, Polynesian influences, and jazz notes to evoke the mid-century era when tiki was culture flourished. The music is not only energetic, it propels the narrative, and something that tickled me to no end is the film's opening titles with Height's title score. And of course, titles like this, all you classic film fans out there, you will recognize them immediately as an homage to the legendary Saul Bass. They are vibrant, bold, and alive, and definitely inspired by the work of Saul Bass. And they were created with the help of Emily Eckstein, art director, Silas Height, and Ralph Smith. And they represent they represented a shared aesthetic sensibility and a collaborative approach to animation and design, as was the intention to create a visually striking introduction that sets the tone for the film. And set it, it does. You watch these opening titles for Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession, and you will not look away. Now, a bit late to the party, Finney was running late, but he joins the conversation and shares his perspective on the organic development of the project. It's interesting how his initial idea for a DIY-style documentary about building a bar, how that evolved once Josh saw Finney's extensive tiki mug collection. Realize, and we get to see much of Finney's tiki mug collection in when you see the documentary. Realizing there was a deeper story about the artist and the subculture. And, you know, Finney makes a big point of saying his initial reluctance, he didn't want to be the film subject, preferring the focus to be on the artist. But he acknowledges that his role as an enthusiastic collector, humanized, provided the human connective tissue for the story, making it accessible to a wider audience. Most of us, we collect something we are obsessive about. That is what, you know, we can tap into with Finney's obsession, our own collectible obsessions. And of course, an interesting aspect of this doc, we talk money and financing. Yeah, it's not too often that I will bring up money with filmmakers because some of them want to talk about, oh, I made this for $8,000. No, filmmakers out there, don't talk about how much it costs to make your film, how much money you raised to make your film. If you don't have a distribution deal yet, you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. Do not talk about how much it cost. But here we talk money in general terms and financing. Talking about financing and how you can come up with financing and structure it is one thing. But don't give out dollar amounts. Please, guys, please. But, you know, the boys describe the logistical and financial challenges of making the film, you know, including the need to travel to and from various tiki hotspots, and the dual task of funding both the bar's construction and the documentary. Now, Josh is extremely generous with his praise of the film's executive producers and a tight-knit group of supporters for making the project possible. They work money miracles, apparently. And as part and parcel to the financial threads of this doc and the building of Kabali, is the collaborative nature of the bar's construction with the artisans and craftsmen contributing their unique skills, often at personal financial sacrifice, but they were driven by the passion for this project. When you're doing builds and remodels, people don't look for contractors who are going to be this generous and do work for free. I think that's a safe bit of advice for everyone. And Josh and Finney and I talk about that. Now, I'm sure you're all asking yourselves the big question. Debbie, you haven't mentioned drinks. This is it's a tiki movie. Tiki mugs, tiki bars. Where are the drinks? Well, those beautiful, fruity, umbrella-wearing drinks that are served in those gorgeous tiki mugs. Don't worry, I've got you covered. As those were two of my big questions when it came to the film's content. We do get to see some beautiful drinks poured and served. We even see a glimpse of a cocktail menu. But no drink recipes are shared. I know. Perish the thought. I did not let that lie, though, folks. On pressing the boys with suggestions for a collector's edition DVD, both Josh and Finney acknowledged my concern and the importance of cocktails, and hinted at the possibility of including recipes and additional content as DVD extras in the future. I'm also looking for custom Kabali mugs. You know, so many of these tiki bars, they have their own mug. So I think that Finney needs to get Kabali mugs and make them available to people as well. It's a fun, fun interview. I had so much fun with the boys. And you can hear it in all of our voices, the laughter, the enthusiasm, the energy. Josh imparts so much wisdom about his experience and the challenges faced in making Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession, that all of you filmmakers and aspiring filmmakers will glean something from this interview, that might aid you in your passion projects. As this truly became a passion project for Josh as well as Finney. So take a listen as Josh Dragota and Finney Finical discuss the wonder and fun of Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for this. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I have to say, Josh, I didn't know what to expect with Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession, and I was more than pleasantly surprised. This is a
Thank you so much.
This is a fascinating documentary, Josh, the way you have interwoven the entire tiki culture and using Finney and his idea of a bar or speakeasy, building that, and then you branch out and you open us up to the artistry and the history, and you bring in book authors like Sven Kirsten, and you just take us through all the different elements of this culture. And it all comes together in that third act when we finally see Kabali open. And it helps understand, it helps us understand, the journey you take us on helps us understand how why Kabali is as it is. Because most of us have been to tiki bars in the past. I know I've been to Tiki Thai, I've been to Trader Vic's many times, Tonga Hut over the years here in LA. But you never really know the history of it. And to see the history and how it all comes together into this one magical, claustrophobic spot is fantastic. So kudos to you on pulling this off.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm an editor by trade, so, you know, you agonize over a lot of media and a lot of interviews, and, weaving those two stories was a challenge, but I'm so glad that you appreciate that. That means a lot to me.
You'd never know that you were trying to weave two stories. It's seamless. It is seamless, it's integrated as one story. So you'd never know that you had two distinct divergent paths that you had to bring together. And that's so key to this film. And I have to tell you, I think your visuals really, really help you with that because they are so vibrant. They are so alive. Ryan Mahaly's cinematography is beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
I'll let him know. You told me.
Capturing all the artwork.
Thank you. He did a phenomenal job. David Taylor, who was our colorist, just knocked it out of the park as well, in post. So we wanted to bring people into that world visually, both sonically and visually, that was the objective.
When it comes to the color and Ryan's work, so you got David and Ryan, whose work, it just piggybacks each other. I have to say, the variety of the camera angles that we have, really fantastic, Josh. We get some slow-mo in there. We get a lot of close-ups. We get a lot of dutching. I love a lot of the ECUs that really let us see the artistry within the cuts in the clay that when it was sculpted.
Yeah.
So we can really appreciate. And then the use of color in building out the tiki mugs.
Yep.
So it wasn't just straight on point and shoot. No, you have a lot of artistry in the camera work and the design that is equal to the artistry within these tiki mugs and the tiki statues. So that's a really nice parallel happening there.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you so much. Thank you. And I have great news. Finney is here. Finney just arrived, so he's on the call now.
Hey, Finney.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for I was listening to some of the stuff that you were saying, and I'm glad somebody else appreciates the amount of craft and storytelling that Josh and his compadres have brought to this.
Oh, absolutely. Now, Josh, you mentioned a word that's very important in this film. In addition to the visuals, you mentioned sound. And sound, I got to tell you, between Silas Height's main title score and then the music throughout and the scoring throughout,
Yes.
You talk about energy. You talk about a vibe. It's like Adventures Surf Sound with Polynesian flair.
Yeah, great. I love that. Can I use that?
Of course you can. But I got the music really moves us along. And it's very perfect for, number one, the whole like mid-century, 50s, 60s, when tiki really began to be taken notice of. But it really fits that, because that type of surf music started with the Ventures and other talents started coming in around that same time if you were part of the California culture or the Hawaiian and Polynesian cultures on top of the traditional Polynesian music. So to have that nice blend in there, and it's almost like building Kabali is almost like, you know, riding the waves up and down and up and down and up and down, and the music captures that beautifully. So Ryan, the music and the visuals are perfection. They're married perfection.
Thank you. I'll let Tony know that. Tony Marzico, who is the genius behind a lot of that music. So, that's cool.
No, that's, I love it. Now, I'm curious. I know you did a short film with Finney a long, long time ago, Save the Tiki. Did that morph into, was that like a calling card or a test film for Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession? Or was that just your introduction, and then you just got wrapped up in Finney's world?
Well, that's how Finney and I... so Finney and I go back. I used to do a little film festival in Tucson, and when I was living out in Los Angeles after I moved out of Tucson, he had called me and said, I'm moving this giant tiki head from one part of the city to another part of the city. And he's like, he knew I was a filmmaker, and this was a bit of time ago. And he said, would you be interested in just, you know, doing a short film? And so we did, and Tony actually did a lot of music for that as well. And we just had a great time with it. But that was just a sweet, you know, we just thought it was kind of like a one-off thing, you know. But when this thing came around, when he started working on this bar, or even before he even started working in the bar, he thought, well, I know a guy. And, Finney, why don't you take it from there? You can give her the why you thought maybe, you know.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing sort of happened organically. I didn't realize that Josh had moved back to Tucson, but he was working remotely during COVID, so a lot of them were working. So I just happened to be starting this project, and I ran into him. And I said, listen, I have an idea to maybe do something, which I originally thought was going to be more of sort of a process or a DIY, you know, building this bar out documentary. And Josh said, well, let me come over to your house and, you know, we can talk about this a little bit. But he thought that, you know, might be kind of interesting. But then when he got there, I don't think that he was quite prepared for the plethora of mugs that were coming out of every room and every closet. And many of them had not been opened for many, many years. And I think the minute he saw the mugs, he said, okay, now here's an angle. Here's something that I can really get my teeth into as far as these artist community and the sort of cult following that they had been building for that point, you know, for about a decade at that point. So it was pretty interesting that, you know, he saw something in the story that I had no idea. And I just have to say, in the very beginning, I had no interest in being on camera or the subject, you know, heaven forbid, the star of the film, right? To me, the stars were these artists. And I think, you know, Josh and Mike Clemens, another producer that was right there at the ground floor, said, you know, if you're not in it, we don't have anybody to sort of humanize it or give you that sort of regular guy thing, you know, hopefully a sympathetic character that the audience would want to root for. But the story sort of being told through the everyman eye, I think, sort of made it a little more accessible. And to, you know, I think that you used a term a little bit earlier where you said, you know, Josh moves the story along, and that was kind of key, because, you know, I think if you're going to relate to people who aren't necessarily into tiki, the pace of the cut and the edit has to be very quick. And I think Josh is very, very quickly, you know, saw there was a story here, a way that he could tell the story of Tiki through the mugs without losing the sort of, you know, the people who are just really into the esoterica of it and you know, that it wouldn't be boring for a lot of people.
And, you know, it's funny, when we first started, I reached out to Tony Marsico because Tony's so tied into that whole world for the Martini Kings. He knows a lot of these tiki artists over all these years, our old punk rockers and all this kind of thing. And when I reached out to Tony and I said, hey, would you be interested in jumping on this thing? He was into it. He was totally game. And he started putting feelers out. And one of the first people that we reached out to was Sven Kirsten, because Tony knows Sven. He's known him over the years. And Sven was game. Sven said, sure, I'm into this. And I'll never forget calling Finney and saying, are you sitting down? Because guess who we just got to go on, who's willing to go on camera? And I told him Sven, and I think Finney was just like, all of his dreams were like starting to come true at that point. And then that, of course, gave way to so many other artists that were willing to go on camera once Sven gave his blessing to be on camera. So it was just, it was fun, you know?
Well, I have to say, and I'm sure Josh was too kind to say this, when he said that needed a face, and every man that people could connect to, he was probably thinking, everybody wants to know what kind of nut has over 1,000 tiki mugs and wants to open a speakeasy.
Thank you, Debbie.
Because that's what everybody's going to connect to. You don't want an every man connection for a documentary like this. You want to know. It's like watching Collector's Call on cable television with Lisa Welchel and all these collectors that she interviews every week and goes to their lair with, you know, lunch boxes or action figures or dolls or something. We want to know the personality. We don't want an everyman. We want to know.
Yeah.
And Finney, you are so high energy and so enthusiastic that for anybody that doesn't, has never even seen a tiki mug, now they're going to want to go see one to find a tiki mug.
Well, I really hope that that's the case. You know, it's I think everybody knows somebody who's really into something. And the big question is, how far are you willing to go?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people tap out before you get to a point that you're going to sell real estate or your vehicle or whatever, to put into something that I was absolutely raised not to do. You don't make these kinds of sort of really poor financial decisions, you know. But it, to me, that was never really, you know, that's, I think that's where you, the word fan comes from fanatic, right? But we were, you know, in the small circle of people that I was in with, to me, this was perfectly normal. You know, these are the coolest things ever. And, you know, this idea that we work so we can have leisure, we can put our, you know, money into things that we really love. And the minute I first saw Sven's book, The Book of Tiki, was really my entree, like many people in the subculture. He's sort of the godpop Tiki. But the minute I saw that, there really wasn't a question. You know, there wasn't this point in time where I said, gee, should I do this? Probably not. And I think that's probably the mark of the obsessive, right? Gotta know more. Gotta get more. Somebody in an interview yesterday said, look, how many tiki mugs do you really need? And I could, the only answer I could come up with was more.
You know, it's it's like asking a woman, how much jewelry do you need? How many shoes do you need?
Yeah, how much you got?
Yeah. And you, of course, you sold your house to get money to help build the speakeasy, to build Kabali?
Yep.
Yeah, I sold a house that I had been. It was actually a rental home that I had, but it's where I was living. And, you know, it was clear that I had grossly underestimated the amount of money that I was going to need. And also that once the project started, I started enlisting some, you know, this really, Kabali, the place, the structure and the room was not built by contractors. It was built by craftsmen. Mm-hmm. These were artists, right? And I think anytime you get into a situation like that, you run the risk of going way overdue and way over budget because, you know, typically they're right range people. That's not where numbers happen. This isn't where, you know, this is. So we were terrible with budgets. We were terrible with timelines. And frankly, I didn't care. It was this sort of moment of truth in my life that it's like, look, are you going to do this or are you going to spend the rest of your life wondering what would happen if you hadn't? And so from the very beginning, and since you know the story, the only guardrails or safeguards that I ever had in my business life were enforced by my partner, who happened to be on a sailing trip where he was going to be gone for the better part of a year. And so, you know, everything just aligned, or if you're him, misaligned, to the point where I could go a little hog wild. I had all this talent around me. And everything, you know, outside of the money, everything was coming very easily.
Mm-hmm.
The room really coming together, and people were starting to drink the Kool-Aid. And then there just wasn't any. I never had a thought about stopping.
So was it?
We're going to go and we're going to go.
Was it Mai Tai flavored Kool-Aid?
Yeah, it definitely was.
You know, I think it's like the project. Because the subject matter has this quirky, fun, you know, everybody, it didn't really feel like work. And I think most people did not get paid near what they should have based on their talent because of their love for the project. And we really had this camaraderie or this, you know, it doesn't matter how many people know about Tiki in the world, we're going to try to change that.
Now, did all of these craftsmen who, based on what I'm seeing in the final product of Kabali, their work is just exemplary. It's beautiful. But did they give you warranties on it?
No way. They don't know what that means.
Oh, my God. You know, the lava wall can fall down on someone. My God, Finney.
It's all insured.
I built a lot of that, of course, raised by an architect, right? And I, at that point, built a couple of bars, but nothing that was even approached being as intense as this. But when you talk about the artist, you know, there was my favorite story that came out of it was the story of Matt Cotton, who's the guy who did the most amazing carved poles.
Yeah.
So much so that everybody, when these photos started leaking out of just what he was doing, people said, "Who's doing these? Is that Crazy Al? Is that who's doing? You know, is this is that Matt? Tell me." And I was like, "You don't know the guy." And they're like, "How do you know I don't know?" I was like, "Well, because he's never done this before."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he really, literally, had never worked in wood like this, and he was such the consummate artist that he was able to assimilate very quickly the do's and don'ts of Tiki, and like a lot of the old Los Angeles carvers, I wanted to have a room full of these artworks that related to each other.
Yeah.
All because they were done by one.
Those wood carvings on the posts, on the poles, are beautiful. Really beautiful. And the finish of the wood, it's not like a simple shellac that you might find in a house. So really... really beautifully.
Art professor, you know, so he knew all the, he just hadn't worked in this particular style, in this particular medium, but being the consummate artist, that didn't dissuade him at all. He sort of just, you know, they were just different tools.
He understood process, he understood structure, he understood all the elements of what the task was. Like, he broke it down into a science.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everybody was sort of at the top of their game. And, you know, we're guys of a certain age and we hadn't quite started to lose it yet.
You know, there's a good line in the movie that, you know, it's not a throwaway, but it's there, and it's there very much on purpose. Because I think the reason I have it in there is because I wanted people to just sort of digest it. There's a moment in which Finney's talking to the gentleman, Mike Vasquez. He's at the construction. He's dealing with all the construction of the place. And he explains, they're talking about what stain they're going to use for wood. It gets a little in the weeds. But Finney says this line where he's like, the idea is all of this stuff should have just been in, like, one place. So, like, the idea is this fantasy, this world in which he's created, is all relative, right? Like, there's a science to it. There's an intent to it. Everything is very intentional. And everybody that started to work on this thing got that. They all got the memo. It wasn't like that was the marching orders. It was like they all just started thinking like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that all comes back to Finney because it's all in his brain. But to Finney's credit, he wasn't like this, like, hardcore guy that was like, no, it has to be this way. He kept people in a space. He understands the form. He's understood the form for decades now. But he let those people play within that world. And I think that's probably, Finney, you can agree or disagree, but
yeah.
I think that's probably why it's such a successful experience when you enter it.
Yeah, I think any good artist, you can only lead them so far, but you don't want to take their art out of it. You know,
right.
So it's a slightly grandiose analogy, but I sort of felt myself as sort of the conductor. But I can't play cello like this guy or violin like this guy. This guy spent his whole life learning the snares or the drums, right? And it's like, I'm not going to tell him how to do his job better. I'm just going to try to lead him to help physicalize this idealized concept that we had. So it was sort of like, give them a construct, but let them flesh it out.
And apply that idea to the filming of it, right?
Right.
So now I'm in a position where I'm you know, following this guy and following this conquest, and I say, well, I need an example of this particular mug, or I need to talk to this person. If this person did this thing and that person did another thing, where in time did that fit? Well, I've got a guy here that is like an expert in it, and so I could always lean on Finney, like if we're going to do a particular, you know, montage of mugs, well, let's make this as intentional as possible. And Finney was always there to, like, guide me as to, well, we don't want to use maybe that person because that wouldn't display what you're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
But this person would, and that design would, and this bar in this location would. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense, Josh. Perfect sense. And that begs the question I have from a production standpoint. You've got over 100 interviews. You have archival materials that are home movies, that still photographs. Amassing all of this, that's not an easy task, which is part of the reason it took several years to make this documentary. How do you, as a director and editor, go about developing your through line? Because part of this is you go back and forth with your timeline. We first start with September 9th of 2023. The 25-minute mark, we jump back to 2022. At the 49-minute mark, we jump to January of 2023. Then at the hour, we're jumping to June 2023. Then we go to August. Then we go back to 2022. Then we go to one of my favorite parts, July of 2023, making the lava walls. I do love watching that. Then we finally hit 2024. So we go back and forth, but you've got all of the archival materials. You've got over 100 interviews. How do you, as a director and editor, start assimilating or get a sense of the through line that you're going to have?
I knew from the beginning I wanted to do a couple of things. I wanted to experiment with this film. I wanted to do something different with this movie than I had done with other films. Number one, I wanted to tell two stories at one time. And I was completely open to the notion that this would be a nonlinear approach. I was totally into that. Number two, I wanted to combine what I've learned over the past, 15 years, cutting trailers and teasers and short form docs, stylistically, sonically, and visually in that direction. I wanted to do those two things. And then the other thing that I wanted to do was try to get as many interviews as I possibly could so that I could almost make the story feel like it's one singular voice.
Mm-hmm.
Like it just, your brain just forgets people. It's irrelevant. It's like, this is a story I'm hearing just as a universal voice. So what you do is you cut two films. And that's what I did. I cut two linear films one of the history of Tiki, and then I cut another pod-based film on the construction of the bar and Finney's life, and I started to figure out how to intertwine those. And that was probably the most challenging part, is finding moments in which we could. I didn't really want to use cards. I wanted to try to find another way, as opposed to using cards, to get from one story to the next story. And we did it. I mean, I'm really happy with that. That's one of the things I'm the most happy with. But it took a while to do that. And we used those little mug chapters going mm-hmm. down through the pike when, you know, the camera goes through and we see the mug. To sort of get from a story A to story B. But if you look at the timeline, and I did the math on this, those two stories add up.
Oh, yeah, they do.
The same amount of time.
They do.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, Josh, that is brilliant to cut two films and then cut them together in the third film, in the final film. Brilliant approach to that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thanks. I'm an editor by trade, you know. That's where I come from. I love editing. I love it. I do it every day. I just absolutely love editing. And I like, you know, going out and shooting stuff and interviewing people, too. So, you know, it's fun. I come from that editing mind, though. So
mm-hmm.
You're
yeah.
always kind of thinking about stuff while you're shooting, you know.
Now, I'm really curious. At what point did you realize you had enough interviews, enough footage? Granted, it makes sense that, okay, things would probably stop once the bar opened. But so often, you know, as I'm sure you have seen, Josh, a lot of filmmakers, well, they'll keep going and they'll get more stuff just in case.
Yeah.
Even after they theoretically have come to they've crossed the finish line. At what point did you know that you had enough so that you could start editing and put this together?
Well, in this case, I was at the mercy of Finney's construction, so I knew that I couldn't be finished until the end of that, whether it opened or he ran out of money. There was always going to be an ending. There was either
right.
going to be a happy ending or there was going to be a sad ending. So that's one thing. But in regards to interviews, the last interview that we got was one of the first interviews that I tried to get. So it took me 3.5 years to get Danny Tiki Diablo on camera. And I was hell-bent on getting him on camera. Finney, we were both hell-bent on getting him on camera because he's such an important artist in the movement. So there were people that we just needed to get. We needed to get Sven. We needed to get Shag. We needed to get Baby Doe and Otto. We needed to get Danny Tiki Diablo. We needed to get Tiki Rob.
Mm-hmm.
We needed to get Billy Shire because he opened up Wacko Soapland. There's just people that I am not giving up on as long as they don't say no. If somebody says no, I understand that. They don't want to be on camera. But I'm going to do everything in my power, and so is Finney, to get those people. So, you know, I guess it's just experience. You know when you're done, you know? I mean, you know you have to stop and, you know, just cut enough films, I guess, you eventually get there mentally.
Did anyone tell you no?
We had a couple of people that just didn't want to be a part. Not that I don't think they had anything against the project, but they just passed on being a part of it. And, of course, those are disappointing things, but in the big scheme of things, when you've got 100 interviews with all these people,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Like, if you don't get a couple of no's, well, you know, there's something wrong with that. You can't get everything you want, right?
Yeah. Now, what's really interesting is the interviews you have, especially with these tiki bar owners and things, it's all over. They're all over the map. How much traveling was involved? Because that's something a lot of people don't think about. You've got to get from point A to point B. You've got time and expense involved in getting from point A to point B and B to C and C to E and D and all of that. How logistically challenging was that?
I'm going to tell you, number one, beyond anything else, you have to praise your executive producers to allowing that to happen. I mean, Bill Ossenbacher was a huge part of helping to make that happen. Johnny Ward and Al Hall, those three guys and their Tucson guys, and of course Finney. Don't forget about Finney. You know, those guys are Tucson guys. Our film is a Tucson film. It really is an indie Tucson film. So you can't get to go to places without the funding to make that happen. So I'm beyond anything else, I'm giving up to those guys for that and giving us the opportunity to be able to tell the story the way we wanted to tell the story, and never ever coming in and saying, oh, I don't think that's gonna work. Never ever doing that creatively in any way. You just know, you mean, you want to go to, you're gonna go to Hawaii, mm-hmm. you're gonna go to Portland, you're gonna go to San Francisco, you're gonna go to LA, San Diego. You've just got to go to these places because they're so such an important part of the history of tiki. I mean, right, Finney? I mean, well, you just have to do it.
Yeah, and you know, building bars and amassing a collection that, like I have, and making movies are not poor man's hobbies, right?
Right.
So, and I was not in a position, you know, it was clear that, and I think it probably comes through in the film, that I'm not exactly what you would call financially responsible or fiscally responsible. So, but the good thing was, the movie wasn't funded through crowdfunding or through a large pool of investors. They were a small, tight group that I think in a couple of cases, you know, I had known for many years, and I think they felt that I was a pretty creative and imaginative guy and that I was very serious about this project. And, you know, I think particularly these days where you can get anything in the world delivered to your house by 5 p.m., you know, we're in this very quick mentality where it just, you know, it can be happened very quickly, and not everything can. I mean, this was an expansive story, both geographically and through the number of people that we wanted to get and the number of people that it touched. And like the bar, it takes time. And there was a lot of decisions. You talked about the editing and the, you know, the same thing was going on the construction. And I felt that it was most important to listen to everybody as much as dictate things. And very often the best idea is not the first idea.
Right.
And so, or definitely not the easiest. Yeah. Right. And so, it really came down to having everybody sort of felt like this wasn't a studio film, so we didn't have this timeline that we had to hit. It was more important about getting the bar right, getting the story right. I have one story in my life. If I'm going to make a movie with Josh about this particular path that I was on, I got one shot at it. So even now, to this, you know, when we're not sure exactly which way we should go, it's like, well, we're going to slow our roll a little bit, and we're going to make sure that we, you know, do it right. And being an obsessive completist as far as collecting tiki mugs, I was the same way about people in the film or people in the bar. I wanted to collect everybody, right? And, you know, I think we came pretty damn close to doing it. And then the flip side of that coin is when Josh started to edit, we had to take out stuff that I never would have dreamed that we, you know, they use this term killing babies. You're just going to leave stuff on the cutting room floor that, and it's because, you know, and when you watch the movie and it's not, you know, it's not a sequential timeline. It doesn't, it's like, it's nonlinear. It's the idea being that they were crafting a story as much as I was crafting a physical story, mm-hmm. you know, in the bar. And that very often doesn't end up, you know, I think at a certain point, and I think this might be true with the filmmaking process as much as it is with the construction process, but at a certain point, we stopped telling the room where it was going to go, and we started listening to where it wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so stuff would have an idea, and we'd be all hell-bent on this is the way we should do this. And the final product is very often far afield from that original concept.
You know, what I find really interesting is that you've got, and this doesn't happen often, but you've got two money fronts happening here. You've got to worry about coming up with money to build Kabali, the construction money, and you got to worry about coming up with money to finance the documentary. So this is a really unique situation, guys. A really unique situation. Josh, you said that, okay, it was either going to, it was, and one of two ways. Either it was a happy end and the bar opens, or money runs out and it doesn't get finished. That is on both sides of the coin. in terms of the financial aspect. So that element is really impressive to come through with financing on both sides of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's impressive. Now, something, Finney, this is, I admit, this is one of my favorite parts of the film, and you did not overlook this. You boys did well. Bar recipes. You devote some time to the bar recipes. This is crucial. But you didn't give us any recipes.
Yeah, there's a lot of secrecy when it comes to this stuff, right? Well, I think there was certain things that we were trying to do and certain things that weren't. And, you know, it's funny you say, you can't overlook that. But there was a point, and I remember it very distinctly, where we were like, we need to do more about the drinks.
Yeah.
Right? There was almost this moment in time, it's like, you know what, we're not doing enough. And Josh called me, he's like the cocktail recipes. And I was at the point where we were starting the menu, and we're like, we almost forgot about the freaking drink.
I remember saying to Mike, like, we don't have anything about cocktails.
Yeah.
And Mike's like, how long do you think you got? Like, what do you think you can do? And I was like, I think, and this is getting in the weeds here, but I think I got like X amount of minutes here where I could put, I have an idea, and Mike, like, let's just see what it looks like in there. Like, put something together and let's throw it in. Let's see what it looks like. And I said, I know exactly where it will go, and where we can, how we can pair it with some other craftsmanship, and it freaking works.
Yeah, it really did. But you got to remember, you're making something that you know can't exceed 90 minutes
right.
as a runtime, and have this all these aspects and elements of this story that needs to be integrated. And I don't think you could have made a film like this if your director was not an editor. Josh, coming from the editing background, knew what he needed to get when he would go out, right? And it's a far cry from somebody just dumping a bunch of footage on your desk and saying, cut me a movie.
Yeah.
Right? And so part was, oh my God, we have this thing, we have to circle back. And then it was to Josh's great credit and his talent that he was able to then intercut all this stuff and make it feel like a unified story. And not a bunch of unrelated chapters. I too think that that's the beauty of the piece that he's made. And in Kabbalah and the Tiki Mug Obsession, is that it doesn't feel like a story made up of 50 interviews. It's almost like, okay, this is just one holistic thing that came together, and that's just the nature of good storytelling.
Yeah, it's not a cut and paste of talking heads.
No.
Not by any stretch of the imagination. But I have to say, Josh, piggybacking what Finney just said, this film, because you have it cut so well, because of the visual interest, the color, and the music, this easily could have gone up to like an hour 45, even an hour 40. And you wouldn't lose anybody.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. Thank you. Cool. Good. Well, I like keeping it tight. I like the idea of people wanting more, which is, and look at, I've said this in like Q&As. It's like, we're in a time right now where and I've been making films since the 90s. Like, mm-hmm. I started shooting on a Bolex and editing on, a reel-to-reel, right? Like, I get it. I understand, hanging film up in bins and remembering stuff, right? It's never been easier in my life to make a movie right now. It's never been easier. But it's also never been more difficult to keep someone's attention.
Yeah.
I mean, you're asking a lot for someone to sit to watch a movie for 96 minutes when that device is sitting in their pocket going off due to notifications or whatever the heck they got going on in there, right? Pausing something, going to the bathroom, making something, taking a phone call, whatever. So it's never been easier, but it's never been harder. And you're consciously thinking about that while you're cutting. Like, okay, how do I keep this moving? How do I keep people engaged? And also, how do I do it my way?
And this is why we should have had actual bar recipes, because everybody will sit there to get the actual recipes for these drinks.
I suspect there'll be a book someday.
Now, there is...
Maybe that'd be a good idea for the DVD featurette. Like a cooking thing. That would be fun.
I mean,
that would be so much fun.
Because I'm looking at these pictures, you know, we're holding a menu. You can kind of make out the titles of some of the drinks, but who knows what's in them. You see some of the drinks being made and juices poured in. And I wanted to know exactly. And I have a good friend who is a tiki nut. She always has been. And her big thing are the cocktails that go in the tiki mugs. So I've already told her about the documentary and she needs to see it. But I know the question that she's going to come back with. Well, where's the drink recipes? So I'm just saying, boys, just saying.
We'll get that in the DVD featurette. We'll have DVD extras and we'll do a couple of drinks.
That's important. But now I do have, there is one big element, Josh, that I do have to ask you about that just swept me in. Your opening titles are so gorgeous. So Saul Bass. Oh my God. Beautiful, beautiful opening titles. Wow.
I am so thrilled that you acknowledge that, because I love opening titles. I'm obsessed with opening titles. I want to make a documentary on opening titles. I love documentary titles. Of course, I love Skull Bass. That was one of those things where when I went to Finney and I said, Finney, can we get this much X amount of dollars? Because I really, really want to do this. Really, really want to do this. And I want to do them like Soul Bass. Like, I want to do them old school. And he was like, we will figure this out. Who do you think can do it? And we got Emily Eckstein and we got Silas Height and my buddy Ralph Smith to help on the visual side, help, you know, wrangle all that stuff. And it's a dream come true. I mean, it really is.
I lit up, Josh, when I saw, as soon as they started popping up on the screen, I just lit up. That is so old school and classic.
That's great. I mean, you hit the audience with this cold open of reality, right?
Yep.
That's it. Boom. You're in the reality. This is the real world. This is real world stuff. And then you take them to a fantasy land so that they can exhale, breathe a second, and then say, okay, maybe this isn't going to be so serious. And boop, then they're on the ride. That's the idea behind all that.
It works perfectly.
The opening theme music, which I think part of this was we Josh and I almost at every instance had the same idea in our head. You know, we're like, yes, yes, yes. There was very, very little, oh, that's not going to work for me. But I remember distinctly saying we wanted something in sort of the Pink Panther-esque theme, you know, and that in the animation. We both loved the idea of doing animation, which is exorbitantly expensive. I mean, I think it's 45 or 48 seconds long, and you know, the actual animation. But when it all comes together, you with the music and the animation and that kind of mid-century modern look, the Saul Bass thing. I mean, we were all fans of it already, and there was never a question like, "Oh, should we try this different style?" We were already on board with it. So the big thing was, can we get the money, and can we get the right people?
That's correct. And by the way, here's the other part of this. So what's awesome about Finney and my relationship with Finney creatively is that we share so many of the same styles of, like, appreciate so many of the same styles. And I can like, send Finney something, and we can talk for, like, forever about fonts and kerning and color choices and matching all that stuff. So Finney and I share that. But then we also have the other producer, Mike Clements, who comes from animation. Mm-hmm. So now you're on a journey where you're like, you have this particular style that you want to convey, and then you've got Mike, who comes from Simpsons, K King of the Hill, various other animated shows,
right,
who have the sensibility and understands the workflow, and just, you know, he'll always be there to be like, this is working or that's not working, or we should try this, you know. So it's just this excellent teamwork that's just like, we're just all in each other's heads. We all share the same sensibility. So it's so much freaking fun. It's just, it's like, and we're pushing each other. We're constantly pushing each other.
Yeah, storyboarding and storyboarding back and forth. This stays, this goes, what if, and yep, there just wasn't any, you know, that old cliche, there just wasn't a bad idea. So you throw everything and then you start cutting.
Yeah. The creativity was just, so just, on,
a lot of talent.
On 11, on 11.
Cold running talent. Yeah. On this, you know, just a lot of people, and a lot of people who had previous relationships with Josh or myself, and you know, I think a lot of them just knew that it was going to be cool. Like, we weren't going to let it escape to the public until we thought it was something that was really cool and hip.
Yeah, yeah. One of the first conversations I had when I started filming this thing, I was out in LA for some business, and I met one of my editor buddies, my buddy Jason Summers. He cuts a lot of docs.
Mm-hmm.
Cut the Faye doc. He worked on the Jaws documentary, the John Williams documentary. Like, he knows feature docs. He's really, 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 you know, an incredible editor. And he's like, so what are you cooking up now? What's the story? What are you doing? And I said, gosh, it's about this guy. And, you know, I went through the whole thing and I showed him the, you know, the tiki mugs and all this stuff. And he's like, you know what you got, don't you? And I was like, what? And he goes, you got an ending. And I was like, I do. And then I go back to where I started with this, Debbie. He says it's either going to be a happy ending or it's going to be a sad ending. He's either going to build this thing or he's not. But you're going to have a story about where you get to that point. And I was like, okay. I kind of like breathe easier. I was like, I think that's cool. We got something here. So, you know, and it was all that creativity that just kept pushing it, pushing it, pushing it.
I have an assignment for both of you now, having seen this. I want to see everything that you left on the cutting room floor, Josh, on a DVD. I want either a director's cut or the movie as it is, but then with all these DVD extras, including drink recipes.
Yeah, well, we're absolutely with you on that because, you know, I think to get a DVD that promises bonus features and they're not really bonus, just one of my pet peeves. So it's like, and I think there was several times during the process of editing, Josh is like, don't forget that we, you know, that, because I just would cringe every time we'd have to take something out. But I think that our DVD, because it's a movie about collectors,
yep,
and, you know, there's people, you know, we all have this sort of gene where we want to own, we want to have a physical thing, is going to be very important for us in the DVD release to have extra content that's actually a bonus.
Yes.
This is really going to, you know, the movie was made for collectors. We'll hope that it'll be a breakout film and reach sort of the general interest viewer. But the first and foremost, it was about pleasing the people that are in the subculture that gave itself to us and trusted its story to us.
Yeah.
And I think that was, you know, the Tiki was big enough to be noteworthy and had a great sort of story arc to it. But still, it was small enough that we could reach these people and meet with them and, you know, have that kind of access to where you could get pretty much functionally everybody who's a playmaker in the Tiki scene to sign off on it. And I think that's just, you know, there wasn't enough content for something that was so visually rich and so historically fun. You know, it's just, I don't know if you could do it if it wasn't in film because it is such a rich tapestry of art that, and to integrate it all in a story with the right music, I mean, it just takes somebody who's really dedicated. And I think you go back to this, like, we just weren't going to do it in short order. It's not something that you can just throw together,
right,
no matter how much technology you have in your hand.
Yeah.
So, now, are we all excited for tomorrow night? Tomorrow night, it Dances with Films. That's a big one here in L.A.
Yeah, this is very exciting. When we when we decided to submit to dances, you know, I said to Finney, if we can get into this, this would be a lot of fun. I mean, mm-hmm. it's going to be good for the film. I mean, what's great about dances is when I lived in L.A., I would see the sign go up, you know? And I was like, man, I'd love to get in that festival someday. Because they just are so focused on independent cinema.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're very supportive. I mean, they got a lot of press in there yesterday. They'll continue to, you know, push press for films and get behind us, you know, and champion us as artists. And so for me, you know, this is 4.5 years ago that we started to shoot on, you know, this film. And to be on Hollywood Boulevard last night at the Chinese Theater, you know, you got Spielberg's new movie is opening at the same theater. It's just really wild. Surreal. It's just surreal. You know, so it's cool. It's really cool. Plus, not to mention, let's be frank here, Tiki Mug Collecting started in Venice Beach.
Yep.
So we're coming back to where it all started for Finney and for Tiki Mug Collectors. And Don the Beachcomber was just across the street. You know, you had the Luau, Beverly Hills, just not all that far away. Trader Vic's. I mean, you know, this is really one of the homes of Tiki, if not the home of
Southern Tiki. California subculture. It really is. It might have started with, you know, a lot of people believe, oh, you know, it's Polynesian. It's actually America's idea of mm-hmm. Polynesia. And a lot of it, I mean, if you had to pick an epicenter, it would be Southern California and, you know, maybe going as far as Oakland, where some of the first places were. But it's a California culture movie.
I mean, Mitch Bumberry talks about how it was production designers that were designing the interiors of, like, Don's and stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, so a lot of the original rental houses for films and stuff, and these guys were people who created the first, what is now known as an immersive environment. So, you know, and then Disney, of course, is a great example. And, by the way, a lot of people got their first taste of Tiki through the Enchanted Tiki Room in Disneyland.
That's exactly
right. No better. I think what you're talking about now is these Tiki bars that, in order to be truly transformative and make you forget about what you're leaving outside, you know, they really need to be immersive. And I just think it's such a unique genre, and I am seeing a lot of young people today in their 20s and 30s coming into Kabali, and they might not know anything about the history of Tiki. In fact, a lot of them don't, but they're coming from a gaming upbringing, or they'll have a knowledge of anime. And so Tiki is really adjacent to all this kind of fantasy thing. It's just escapism sort of that is able to be translated to a next generation. And I think that that's why we have a real chance to help this not go away, you know? I think I have that line in the movie. It's like one eye on the past and one eye on the future.
Yeah. As Kate Flannery says in the documentary, Tiki's going to be around for at least 10 generations more.
Yes. I think she's right. I really do. I'm not a doom and gloomer about anything, and certainly not about Tiki.
Nope.
So, you know, as long as I'm kicking, it'll be devoted to serving the past, but also, where can we go from here?
Yeah.
Guys, I can't thank you enough. This has been an absolute joy. So much fun talking to the both of you about Kabali and the Tiki Mug obsession. I hope you get a sellout tomorrow, and I know everybody that sees the film is going to love it. And they're all going to want to buy DVDs with all those bonus extras.
Yeah.
And mugs.
And mugs. We need mugs. You need swag. People love swag. Yeah. They need to be able to order Kabali mugs.
Yep. Well, we're working on all kinds of fun stuff, and we're planning on bringing this to different cities and doing a one night special event at all around the whole country to different Tiki communities.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for this time and your support. We really appreciate it.
As I said, this has been so much fun. And Josh, I sincerely hope that you'll actually cut some features and do another documentary, direct it, and we can chat again about that experience as well.
Would love that. Would love that.
Guys, thank you. Thank you so much. And here's to a great, great screening at DWF tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. And that was director and editor Josh Dragota and subject and obsessive tiki mug collector Finny Finnickle talking about Kabali and the tiki mug obsession. Now, for more information on Kabali and upcoming film festival screenings, where you can see it, and for any distribution news, because I know this is going to get snatched up by a distributor, go to Kabali, Kabali.com. And if you're in Southern California, you can catch Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession on July 18th at 5 p.m. at the Bay Theater, the historic Bay Theater in Seal Beach. So put that on your calendars. And there's going to be, it's like cinema and sound presentation. So there's the movie, and then after the film, there's going, the Martini Kings are going to be performing. So that's all I've got to say about Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession. I teased it for a few weeks while Dances with Films was going on, and I couldn't fit it in. So now the boys get their own bonus episode of BTL for the film. But be on the lookout for more bonus episodes of Behind the Lens. And as always, head on over to BehindTheLensOnline.net for more movie reviews and interviews. And there are plenty, with 7 more already queued up to drop this week. So, until next time, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.